This episode of TechPod is brought to you by thwack.com, the SolarWinds community for IT pros. That's where you'll find the Monitoring for Managers forum, where we look at monitoring from a manager's point of view. Join the conversation at thwack.com/M4M.
Databases are one of the fundamental areas in IT that cause never-ending friction between the folks doing the work and people managing those critical teams. The reason for this is largely rooted in the opinion of practitioners that if management would just learn a little about the tech, they would understand why the requests were so essential. Meanwhile, leadership spends a not insignificant amount of time wishing those same experts would learn to explain what they are doing in plain English, or at least ways that didn't induce immediate narcolepsy. This episode of SolarWinds TechPod is part of our ongoing mini-series on monitoring for managers. I brought along my fellow head geek and database aficionado, Kevin Klein. Together, we're going to break down the essential things about databases and database monitoring that a manager might need to know without all the sleep-inducing technobabble. Kevin, welcome to TechPod.
Hey, Leon.
Okay, so before we dive into the main topic, normally this is where we do some shameless self-promotion. We let our guests talk about the company they work for and the kind of work they do and the stuff that they're doing on the side. So are you working on any special projects, or you've got some appearances coming up, or anything that you want folks to keep an eye out for?
Well, yes, indeed. I have two conferences that I'll be appearing at throughout the end of the year in person, actually. Mm-hmm. So that's a difference. SQL Live 360 in Orlando, and then also Dev Intersections will be in Vegas in December of this year. So I'll be speaking at both of those events. And then in terms of special projects, a couple interesting things to mention. One is I'm actually doing in my own webinar series, a three-part series on building persuasion, credibility, and leadership skills. So if you're interested in this topic today, I think you'd probably be pretty interested in attending those webcasts as well. And then finally, I'm working on two simultaneous book projects right now.
Oh my gosh, because yeah. Sleep is for the weak.
And I am weak, I'll tell you. So in early January, I believe SQL in a Nutshell, 4th edition, will be coming out. My bestseller. Woohoo!
Yay!
And then, and then probably sometime in Q1 of next year, a new book by A Press, Professional Database Migration for Azure SQL.
Great. Okay. And thank you for not having the, for complete morons or anything like that. Okay, wonderful. Well, let's see. I am not 100% sure what my end of year travel schedule looks like. It has been pretty much since the end of the before times that I haven't gone anywhere. I might make it out to, I think, reInvent, but that's still up in the air. And that's about the only travel I know of. And as far as side projects, I actually do like my sleep occasionally. So I'm not coming out with anything big soon. However, I would hawk my book that I wrote a couple of years ago now, which is The Four Questions Every Monitoring Engineer Is Asked. It's good for any time of year, but it's especially geared for the sort of springtime and the Passover season. But it's, not really a religiously based book, but you can pick it up wherever fine ebooks and manuscripts are sold. So, okay, with that out of the way, I want to dive into our main topic. Again, monitoring and database monitoring for managers. And I want to start off with looking from, let's say, the management view inward toward the team. What do you, in your experience, what do you think non-technical managers who lead engineers need to know so that they can be better leaders?
Yeah. And this is a critical question, particularly today in an age of the Great Resignation, where so many people are either A, refusing to come back into the office, and because of that, they're looking for new employment, or B, they just need a change and they're moving on. So if you're not implementing or acting upon some of the better practices as a non-technical manager of technical people, they're going to be unhappy and they're going to start looking elsewhere. So one of the first bits of advice I would encourage people to implement in this situation. And it's funny because I was a technical person promoted into management over technical people, and it took me years to learn this lesson. But the lesson is stop interrupting us. Right. So what do I mean?
It's so true.
Isn't it? Right. You know, but I learned this lesson probably in the late 90s, early 2000s. And later on, lots of reports started to come out and talk about this concept of flow. Right. Where it takes, you know, if we context switch between going to a team meeting and then we're back to writing code, or we're back to doing some work with our network, or, you know, as an admin or something, it takes us a while to get in the flow of things. And it could be 5 minutes, it could be 20 minutes, but it takes a little while. And then you get into this really good place where you're getting lots of work done. You're really in the zone. You've lost track of time. And then boom, comes the next interruption. And so in my own case, what I had started to do, just because my predecessor had done it this way, was we held our team meetings, whatever, like if it was a review or if it was a status meeting, we always held those at 10 a.m. And so that meant you come to work, you have a cup of coffee, you chat with your colleagues for a few minutes. And then you start to work, you get about 45 minutes in, and then you're interrupted to go to the 10 a.m. meeting. You come back, get to your desk, get another cup of coffee, start to get into the flow, and then it's lunchtime.
Right. You missed the part where you bag on either the project or the guest speaker or whoever was in the meeting or whatever they were talking about. So that chews up a few more minutes. Like the walk from the meeting also is, then you get your cup of coffee, you bag on them a little bit more. And then, like you said, it's lunchtime. And where did the morning go? Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. And although the amount of free time that I was providing to my team was essentially the same, when I learned that I was introducing that need to get into flow, that time for context switching, what I realized is, you know, move the meeting in such a way that it abuts another breakpoint in the day. So from once I realized that I was killing everybody's productivity, all of our meetings happened either just before lunch or just after you came back from lunch. Mm-hmm. So that in the morning, yeah, you know, we didn't get any extra time from the 10 a.m. meetings. We still had a, you know, cumulative 2.5 hours, but because it was the meeting and then to lunch, there wasn't that context switch that happened, and everybody was able to get a little more work done, a higher productivity, you know, a little bit more in the zone.
You know where I see this now? It's really interesting that in the developer world, I'm seeing a lot more tools where the information, the monitoring, the alerting, all that stuff is bolting into the IDE, into the developer's environment itself, so that they never have to leave the code environment to see how the code is operating, or to see that error message, or to see that request, that, you know, that pull request or that change request or whatever it is. It's all happening within. Same idea. This is where I get my work done. This is where I'm the most valuable for the company. Every time you pull me away from this, you lose money. You lose features, functionality, like you said, that flow time. So everything you can do to keep me in the place where I am the most useful is a benefit to everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, in fact, previous years of our IT professional surveys that we have done and that other organizations have done have kind of reiterated this lesson learned. You know, please just give us enough time to get some work done.
Right. Right. So what else? Okay. So that's the big one. What else is on the list of things that non-technical managers ought to know?
You know, non-technical managers really struggle with the issue of level of effort.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, a lot of times, if you're a consultant, you probably experience this on a daily basis where you talk to a client about the new app you're going to build, and they want the carrying capacity of a ocean-going cargo freighter. They want the speed of a jet aircraft, and mm-hmm. and they want the comfort of a limousine. And it's like we know that's impossible. You know, these are contradictory sort of requirements you're asking for. But B, How long does it take to make an airliner or a cargo vessel? You know, it takes years in some cases, depending on the kind. And so one of the things that, you know, happens so often that always kind of sets my spider senses tingling is when a user or a manager says, oh, it should, you know, that shouldn't be too hard. Let's add a field to this form, right? And
yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing in which, you know, when someone they don't have an awareness of systems, right? They tend to think of life as a series of discrete objects and interpersonal interactions. You know, the kind of thing where you meet somebody and you're like, God, that person must hate me. And you're not thinking about the fact of, you know, his wife is getting treatment for breast cancer, and he just spent all morning with her. She's exhausted. He's exhausted. They're hopeful, but life is hard right now. And that's just kind of his face, right? Or, you know, you look at a form where you're doing data entry, and you're like, well, let's just put a little extra field there. And you're like, yeah, but that also means documentation. That means QA and testing. That's got to be part of the project plans. You know, that's got to have all kinds of analysis in terms of downstream and possibly upstream implications. And so one of the things that lessons learned from the world of agile and development is you don't estimate in kind of a natural looking curve of effort. They use something called the Fibonacci sequence, which is you take two numbers and add the two previous numbers to get the next number in the sequence. So your first level of effort is one, and then one, but then your next level of effort after that is two. And one plus two makes three, then the next number is two plus three is five, then eight, and then it gets bigger and bigger very quickly. And so it's the kind of thing that, well, all right, well, maybe on this particular form, adding a field is not a big deal because the database already has that field added. But before long, you know, oh, let's add this new feature set where we're going to have a whole new set of pages on our dashboard in the SaaS portal. Oh, you're not talking about a single day. You're talking about quite a bit of time. And so a lot of managers don't really understand the actual level of effort. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's so important for you as a manager to try to build warm relationships in which you can trust the feedback you're getting from your team, knowing that they're not steering you wrong.
Right. I also think that another element of Agile is the idea of story points that, and it doesn't have to be like story points is a very ephemeral concept, right? You could ask your technical team to give you a pile of Monopoly money. And then every time you ask as a manager for a feature or for a deliverable or for a project, they will charge you. They will tell you that's going to be another $1,000 handed over until you realize that all the money in the pot is gone and you've spent it. But whatever it is, whether it's story points or pickles, or I've heard all sorts of creative ways of, you know, of defining it. Having a way of quantifying of as a team, you as the manager, them as the individual contributors, defining the level of effort so that you have a visual of, because on this project, adding a form is a $1 item. But on this form, it happens to be a $300 item. When I was a long time ago, when I was, you know, part of a team that was installing phone systems, and people said, well, how much is this going to cost? I said, the first phone we install in your office is going to cost $15,373. The second phone we install is going to be $5.25 for the handset. Well, why is the first phone so expensive? Because we have to put in all the cabling and the server and the rack and the, you know, switches and all of that stuff. You can't have even the first phone without that one. So it really, you know, I'm just installing a phone, but the context matters. And working with your team to help get a trustworthy, meaning that you trust, to your point, you trust that they're telling you accurate information. They're not sandbagging. They're not exaggerating because they know you're going to ask for more later, whatever. And at the same time, they trust that you understand when what you're asking for. And that when you say, no, I do need the $1,000 item, I really do, that they can trust that you understand what it is that you're asking for and you mean it. So those are all big things.
Just as a sidebar to that too, I find that in general, IT people tend to be really exuberantly optimistic. Even the most pessimistic or introspective and introverted IT person, when you ask them, how long will it take to get this done? You know, you'll see them cock their head and get that dreamy expression of, you know, deep concentration on it. And what they're also doing is they're thinking, well, if I was in a perfect world and all I had to do was work on this project, oh, I bet you it'd only take me 4 hours to get that done. And so they come back and say 4 hours. But then, you know, you've got to back off of that and get a little bit higher perspective and say, oh, well, you know what? You don't have 4 hours of uninterrupted time very often in your day, Mr. .net. So, you know, this might take 2 or 3 or 4 calendar days, business days, for you to actually get around to getting all of that stuff done. You know, that sort of thing. So it's, although we often don't think of ourselves as being optimists, the way we just think about our processes is when we have to give an estimate, we tend to do it at, under the best of conditions, but we don't live under the best of conditions. So you can just get some grossly, wildly inaccurate estimates because of that.
Yeah. And even when we're estimating based on not optimal, but nominal, meaning the normal conditions, just the ones that every day, your every day isn't actually every day. Your every day is probably one of the most, you know, better moments of the week, but there are a lot of really bad ones along the way and a lot of distractions. The funny part is I live on both sides of this divide. When my wife asks me how long it's going to take to get a particular thing done, or I'm working on some improvements in the house or whatever, she will routinely double and add half again to whatever time frame I tell her. How long is this going to take? I think it's going to take me like 2 hours to do. Okay, that's like 6.5. Okay, good. All right. You know, whatever it is. She does that all the time to me. Meanwhile, one of my good friends, Dennis, will tell me, oh, we're going to do blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, now, Dennis, I want you to think about that again. But remember that there is gravity and oxygen. Yeah. You know, we're doing this on Earth with our normal rules of physics. And he'll stop and I'm like, oh, right. Okay. So then we can't do this. And we can, and you can see him rewriting the entire project in his head because he was doing it in some like bizarre fantasy world that exists only between his ears. But yeah, it is amazing. Another thing that I would love for non-technical managers, specifically with databases and database monitoring, is to recognize that even if you have a really solid grasp of monitoring in a regular application, IT operation sense, you know what matters. You know, CPU, RAM are high among them. There's other things too. For databases, it's an entirely different world. The things that matter for databases don't matter in any of your other situations. And the things that matter in the other situations are really not as important as there. So I would like you to take a minute and talk about that.
Yeah, that's an outstanding point, Leon. You know, how many times have you opened Task Manager to do troubleshooting and then had to sit back a little bit and think about, okay, so what's Crystal doing on my computer at the moment? Does she have locks on those files? And how about Liz? What's she up to?
I have never thought that. I have never, ever thought that.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the name of the game with databases. Databases aren't just an Excel spreadsheet writ large. Databases are an extremely elegant but very sophisticated and complicated way to allow thousands of people to simultaneously work on the same mission-critical data to your system. Probably the systems that are responsible for, you know, millions of dollars of revenue for any sizable organization. So huge problems are introduced into database systems, not because you've got a CPU problem or a RAM problem, but because it's a multi-user, highly concurrent system where you have to make sure that a transaction never disappears into the ether. You know, a transaction handling data is either fully committed and fully recoverable at any moment, but also fully reversible as well. That's the whole reason relational databases were invented back in the late 70s, early 80s, was mainframes would lose track of you, your data, all the time. And, you know, although we're peasants and we don't have millions of dollars, when you lose track of our money, we'll grab the torches and the pitchforks and we'll storm the castle, right? So, so people said, okay, we got to figure out a way to make sure that this doesn't happen. And that's the kind of thing you have to consider in monitoring databases. It's not, CPU is real. Memory shortages do happen. So you need to monitor those kind of standard bare metal infrastructural components, but you also need to watch things like all of the different kinds of weight statistics that are accumulating. Locking and blocking are massive issues. We have other kinds of issues unique to databases like deadlocks. So there's quite a bit in there that is unique to databases, and also as part and parcel of that, how good your skills are with designing and writing for a database can determine whether you have a lot of that or a little of that. And so that's why it's also really important for managers to know who's the best devs on, you know, on one of our application teams who can write good SQL as opposed to great JavaScript or what have you, because they are not identical skills.
Right. And this is where monitoring becomes not a cost center and not a warning system, but a development tool that will help you build better code. Because, okay, let's say that your best dev didn't work on this particular aspect of the application. And so you're seeing a lot of, you know, deadlocks or locking, you know, or waits associated with a particular function. You can go back and say, look, we're seeing this. Let's review the SQL that you're writing, that you're using in your code. Oh, I see. Let's put that into a query plan. Let's see how it executes and let's start to play around with it. Let's rearrange it. And we realize that there are ways to make that same code run more efficiently on the database side, which makes the application run more efficiently, et cetera. Everybody's happy. But you know that from monitoring, not from necessarily, you know, great code discipline or a super duper IDE that has, you know, context based, you know, autocomplete or, you know, or your, you know, your best ability to copy and paste from, you know, Stack Overflow or whatever. Like, you know, monitoring really can be an improvement tool. So yeah, I love it. And the same thing goes for that connection between storage and the database, which I think a lot of people overlook. They think, yeah, storage, like whatever, you know, it sits there. What's the big deal?
Right. Yeah. So many people tend to think of storage as just a simple commodity. And it's actually, I do a presentation called Top 10 Mistakes That DBAs Make. And number 10 on the list is thinking about storage only as volume of data that you can put your databases into. But storage is so much more than that. It is also the speed, the central keystone of performance because of latencies and things like that. It's massively important. And then there's all kinds of other aspects of data that typically a DBA or dev is not going to think of because we have that one hard disk that sits there in our workstation. But when you're talking to the SAN administrator is usually thinking about their storage, which becomes your storage, in terms of cost, right? So you're like, I need a 50 gigabyte allocation on the SAN so I can deploy our new database. We only think it's going to be 20 gigabytes by the end of the first year, but I'll have room to grow. And so the SAN admin says, hey, great, no problem. And then they go behind the scenes and give you three disks in a RAID 5 array, which, as it turns out, RAID 5 is not good at all for write-heavy workloads. It's quite a bit slower. And, you know, it's okay for read heavy workloads, but for write heavy workloads, RAID 5 writes a parity bit for every bit that it puts on the disk. So it's doing a heck of a lot more writes to get the same amount of work right. done.
Now, I'm going to pull a conversation back because remember, this is for non-technical managers. And while we could spend all day talking about the, you know, the write latency and the 12 and the cost of 12 and things like that. The point is that as you're speccing out an application as a manager and the budget is coming into play, you're probably, you know, you've already sprung for as many CPUs as the team has asked for. You've already sprung for all the RAM. Do you really need a flash, you know, flash array, which is, you know, three times more expensive in terms of inter-office cost or however you do your, you know, your money? Isn't RAID 5 good enough? I mean, the storage is there and you'll have it. And the reality is, no, it's not. That storage in a lot of cases is your price versus performance fulcrum. And the thing as a manager to recognize is to make an informed choice, to understand that that choice of where the storage goes isn't just about dollars. All storage is not created equal. And it's not only just about how fast the disks are. Because again, as a consumer, I can say, well, I've got a, you know, 3,600 millisecond read time, or I've got a, you know, whatever it is. No, it's not just about the read time on the disk itself. It's about, again, how it's allocated. Is it allocated all at once, or is it expanding storage? That can take a little bit of performance hit too. Is it on, you know, flash? Is it on, you know, something like that? And that you select the right storage for the purpose. That to a manager is the important thing.
So you mentioned the price performance fulcrum, and you know, this is even more important today. Now that we have a lot of people, if they're not already in the cloud, they are considering it, right? And adoption for using the cloud is going way up. And so one of the things I'd encourage everyone to remember, and this is goes back to Leon's point about monitoring, isn't just about when things break. Here's an example. If you move to the cloud and you're so excited that you're going to be saving all kinds of money, remember that the cloud has built-in latencies on top of all the other latencies you get from the systems themselves. That's because it's on the internet far away from where you are sitting at your desk. So let's say it's got a, by default, it's going to have a 30 millisecond latency just to go across the wire. So now you have systems that are much slower than they were before because you opted for the cheapest kind of cloud storage that they have. You know, it's still hard disks, let's say, for example.
You chose poorly.
Yes, you chose poorly. And so the thing that a lot of people discover, much to their chagrin, about being in the cloud in a way that they often don't think about on premises is that you can get the performance you need, but it's a balancing act. You've got the fulcrum on which price is balancing on one side and performance on the other, and you can turn that dial in the cloud to up your performance. But boy, oh boy, watch the dollar signs just start rolling by like Bugs Bunny's eyes in the cartoons when he hits the jackpot in a slot machine. It really gets expensive fast. So I encourage managers, if you ever have a part to play in setting requirements, don't just set functional requirements for your apps. Set performance requirements as well. So a lot of the time today, users think, if the website is slow, that's the same as the website is down. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, spending a few extra pennies at the get-go, at the onset, could save you a lot of recrimination from your users later on who are like, this is barely usable. Right. And you're like, look, you have to wait 1 second for the screen to come back and respond. You're like, that's too slow.
It's forever. It's forever. Yes,
exactly.
I also see this as a function of who built the cloud environment in the first place. When we're talking about on-prem, and I've talked about this before in other venues, but when you're talking about on-prem, there is a team of people who've been building the environment, the network engineers who understand how data is flowing and how the firewall rules and how the traffic patterns are going. We're all deeply intrinsically involved in it. Even if it wasn't for this project, the environment itself was architected in terms of network. And the storage, likewise, the storage environment, the first three arrays are specifically for these kinds of applications. And then the storage administrators have these, and these permissions are on these kinds of LUNs and things like that. And And then the developers come in and they explain, my application is going to do X and Y and Z. And therefore, all the other experts, storage, networks, security, and so on, get together and they say, all right, we're going to give you this security and this storage. You see who's involved. With cloud native applications, a lot of times the person building the application, the developer, is the one actually going and doing the clicking in Azure or AWS. And the problem with that is that they're using a choice of a set of menus, and they're not even sure what the options necessarily mean or the downstream impact of it. So my advice to the managers listening is that even though your developer probably understands, you know, everything they need to know about how the application is working, that doesn't mean you shouldn't get other experts involved to just give a look over on what is the security you put on that S3 bucket. Oh, it's wide open. Yeah, we won't be doing that. That's a bad idea, you know, or whatever it is. Have those experts, the network engineers. I know it's not your on-prem network, but they still have input to how your AWS-based application should be built and architected from a network standpoint. And that takes us to another storage-based topic, which is backups. Let's talk about those for a little bit. And I'm going to start off with a quote from our friend Karen Lopez. She's been on TechPod and she's been on other SolarWinds shows frequently. And she recently tweeted out something that I think is just really, really well put. And it's concise. You don't need backups. You need restores. And that's the emphasis I think that we both want to make, is that people put an unnecessary amount of importance on the back. Have we been doing our backups lately? Let's make sure we get those back. Let's grandfather them in. Let's make sure that we're putting them over here. It's not the backups you care about. It's the, can you restore it later? That's the part you actually want. And that's the part that too many people don't even think about at all until it's too late.
So very true. I experienced this firsthand back in the day. SQL Server, ironically, and a lot of databases are this way. They will let you back up a database that is corrupted. And then you pull out what appears to be a perfectly normal looking backup file, and you go to reapply it, you know, to restore it. And SQL Server or the other database platform will say, sorry, I can't restore this corrupted file. Go back to your last good backup. And you're like, well, when was that? When did this problem happen? I don't know. The first time it ever happened to me was in the mid-90s. And I had to go back a couple days to find one that worked. And it was just a massive heartache. And so it was at that time that we actually started to build in a practice that you have to first do all your preventative maintenance checks, corruption checks and things. If it passes, back it up. But if it doesn't pass, there's no sense in backing it up because you can't restore it. The next thing I learned was, because restore is the ability to restore is what's critical, not the backup itself. We actually started to build in restore tests as part of our process. So on a regular basis, we would not only take the backups and take a look at the backups, make sure they work, but we would restore those to secondary servers and make sure everything worked fine. And this was a big improvement for us. And one of the surprising benefits of that is that the next time we actually had a real failure, the kind that gets the CEO alarmed and the CIO is like pacing in your cube, which we all love that, right?
Oh, yeah. It helps me work. I'm so much more effective when I have a senior executive looking over my shoulder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that enabled me to actually say to them, you know, I believe that this will be 45 minutes and we'll be done. And it was actually the deputy CIO in my case, and his name was David. And he said, well, how do you reckon that? And I said, well, I did a restore test over the weekend. It took us 43 minutes, a little bit of data growth. So let's say 45 minutes. And he was surprised, but he was impressed. He's like, okay, I'll check back in 45 minutes. And he left my cube. And I thought at that moment, I'm the most powerful DBA in the world. So.
But it does bring up an important point for managers to understand about restores, because again, we're not talking about backups. We're talking about the restores. That's the part you want, which is RTO and RPO. Then those are the two things that, again, as a manager, you want to, it's not just a matter of saying we need to back things up or we need to be able to restore. It's about how fast and how much. Could you just take a minute though and dig into that RTO and RPO concept?
Yeah. And this is even more important now for those of you listening who may be moving to the cloud. And I'll explain that in just a moment. So RPO is recovery point objective, and RTO is recovery time objective. So basically what that means is recovery point is how much data are you willing to lose? So let's say, for example, you've got a conference scheduling system that is running on PostgreSQL and it goes down. Well, what happens if how bad is it if you have to rekey the last hour's worth of data into that system?
No. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. People.
Yeah, it's not happening.
They're like, you mean the conference scheduling system went down for the whole day? Whoop-de-doo, right? So you wouldn't mind if you lost an hour or two or, even multiple hours. On the other hand, if this database system actually generates huge amounts of revenue, you might not even want it to go down for 2 minutes. So in that case, with this very, very valuable system, you would have not only a recovery point objective, you would also want to start factoring in high availability, right? So that you have a secondary standby server ready to go at any moment. So that's how much data are you willing to do without if the system goes down. Recovery time objective is how much time are you willing to allow the team to have to work on it to get it back up and running. So let's say our standard back when I ran the DBA team was that we wouldn't lose more than 15 minutes of data, and it wouldn't take more than 15 minutes for us to restore if the system crashed. So that is the recovery point objective of 15 minutes and the recovery time objective of taking no more than 15 minutes to get back up and running. And again, this is the kind of thing that if you don't regularly test it, you won't know if you can meet those requirements. Now, one of the reasons it's so important to think about this a lot and plan for this if you're doing a database migration to the cloud is that one of the ways that we as database people would enable this to happen within those time limits is we would do things like we'd have the full database backup from yesterday sitting on the server. And then on top of that, we would take, let's say, every 15 minutes, we would take a transaction log backup so that we could, if the server went down at 3:30 in the afternoon, we could restore yesterday's backup right from the local disk. All of those transaction log backups from the time it crashed until the most recent 15-minute increment, and we'd be back in business in no time at all. But in the cloud, you have to pay for all that extra storage. So we've got a situation where, in some of our servers, we'd keep 2 or 3 days of backups even in case there was a logical failure, right? Like they had rolled out some new changes to the software and that's what messed things up. And so we have to get around the logical failure. So we go back 2 days before the deployment. Well, if you put all of those backups onto your cloud services, you're paying 3 times as much as you were before for storage.
Right.
So you,
and it may be worth it. I mean, it might be worth it, but you can't assume it's worth it. And right. As a manager, you have to recognize what it is that you're picking. You know, you could have a really frugal dev or DBA who says, oh, there's no way they'd want to pay for that. But leadership may say, oh, no, we absolutely are willing. Those are dollars well spent. It could be, but if you don't know what you're picking,
That's right. Don't go into it in ignorance.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Those two things are very important. And in fact, now you'll see in there's, for example, a really outstanding, excellent set of PowerShell scripts for SQL Server DBAs. It's called dbatools.io. And its creator has been on some of our other sessions in the past, Chrissy Lamar. And as one of the modules in there, in PowerShell, it does exactly what it took us months to figure out of pulling a backup, restoring it elsewhere on another SQL server, and giving you the time that it takes to do that. So now you can build kind of a trend analysis of how long it takes for you. So this is now, you know, kind of a well-accepted industry best practice. But on top of that, there's kind of an overall framework for RPO and RTO, and that is set within your SLAs, your service level authorization, or service level agreement. And there are even some people now who are going a step beyond that, service level SLO, and that I don't even know what that means. Objective, that's what it is. Yeah, exactly. So the SLA is kind of the letter of the, you know, the contract to the letter. And the SLO is the contract to the premise of what you want to achieve. We as a business, you know, have these goals and objectives for the SLO. For the SLA, though, just to illustrate the point that it's kind of to the letter of the agreement, of first time I ever had to sign one of those, I was very, very worried because we didn't really know and we didn't have any empirical evidence to support that we could meet the needs that were laid out in the SLA. And so we cheated. So SQL Server,
like
everybody does. It was mutually satisfactory cheating, but what we did is SQL Server and many database platforms allow you to create a kind of a hierarchy of objects inside of your SQL Server database. And for example, you might have one file group that's called primary and another file group that's called secondary. And you put some of the tables of your database into the secondary file group, knowing that that is actually an older SAN that is hard disk based rather than the newer one that mostly is going to give you different kinds of really fast cache. But everything in that secondary file group is kind of lukewarm data or even cold data. You know, it's the financials from 2 years ago that, yeah, that's used in some trending, but you don't really query it regularly at all. So we kind of did the equivalent of that, in which we put the tables and the indexes that were used most often into one group that would come up right away. And then those that were used less often, usually like month-end reports and things like that, that went into another group that took a little longer to restore outside of the bounds of the SLA. And so that's how we were able to get things moving to satisfy their needs. But like you said, at the time we were doing that, there weren't really many monitoring products or tools out there. And so that's when, you know, I as a DBA began to think about, you know, what would really be great would be to know empirically, based on my performance data, can I meet these SLAs? What is normal behavior? Because how can I truly figure this to be abnormal if I don't know what normal is?
Right, right. All right, so I want to pivot away from the things that we wish managers would know about. I think that covers a few really good areas, and talk about some of the struggles that we've heard managers, specifically non-technical managers who are working with database monitoring folks or database, database experts. What are some of the struggles you've heard out in the field from those folks? Now, you mentioned one earlier, and I'm just going to bring it back again. How do I know that my team is telling me the truth? How do I know if they're BSing me or not? So what do you, you know, what do you say to that?
Yeah, you know, this is where I think, you know, good team dynamics, friendly relationships really, really come into play. And sometimes, you know, people are stressed out and they're going to fudge the numbers. But if you are a cohesive team, that helps a lot. People are generally going to try to be as honest with you as they can. Of course, they may be overly optimistic or that sort of thing. But the other thing that in talking to a lot of leaders who have gotten to a place where they feel really comfortable with what their team tells them, they do a couple things. One is they have some element of play together, right? They enjoy, there's something about the way they're working together in which they enjoy each other's company. So I've heard of, in fact, I recently talked to one team leader who, during the pandemic, they weren't able to go in person to any kind of user groups or things that they had previously done that were enjoyable. So they decided as a group, they were still working in the office, and they decided as a group that they would have kind of a lunch and learn once a week, where they'd pull a video from a big conference or, you know, from Microsoft Learning or Pluralsight, and they'd watch it together. And then after a while, it turned into something fun because it got from where it was just informative to it got to be a little bit fun, where one of the team members decided to buy a giant two buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken for everybody. And then it became, hey, we're, you know, next Tuesday is the chicken train, you know, and they'd send messages around that, you know, they were just having fun with this idea of, hey, that chicken was great. Then it was like, oh, now I'm looking forward to this time together with the team. And what developed there was this kind of crosstalk where one of the team members was especially good at SQL, and another couple of them were really good at the different coding languages they were using in the IDE. So sometimes, you know, they'd lean across the table as they watched a video with finger-licking goodness all over their fingers. And one of, you know, one of them would say, hey, you know, I don't think that would work in our environment because we do XYZ. And it doesn't seem, and the other person might say, oh, well, counterpoint, you know, if we changed how we're doing recording this in Microsoft Team Foundation server, we might be able to get away with it. So what happened was the manager couldn't tell if the person was BSing them on some highly technical point of Angular or, you know, Node.js. But the way the team worked together, everybody was kind of cooperatively coming to conclusions and coming to consensus that way. So if the manager said, can we get this done by next Tuesday for this emergency request? The team together would say, oh, you know, well, no, I don't think so. And then somebody else on the other side of the table would say, well, yeah, we could, but we would have to not do any work on this and such part that we've been tasked with. And the team leader could say, oh, you know what? I can make that happen. Let me talk to the boss further up the chain.
Right. I mean, you know, like all relationships, you know, a good marriage, et cetera, you know, communication is the key. I would also say that what you're talking about is a level of trust. You know, people talk about trust all the time. You have to trust them. You have to trust them. But there comes a point where functionally, what does that mean? Do I trust them? Do I trust them to hold me dangling over a building? I mean, that's not really part of my job description typically. So what does that mean? And you hit upon something, which was that within a team, there's trust not only that people's strengths will be acknowledged, but also that their gaps, if you want to call them weaknesses, will be respected. Meaning that if you can trust that you're able to say, I'm actually not good at that, and that it will be respected if somebody says, I'm not good at that, and I don't want to get good at that. That's not something that I'm interested in, versus somebody who says, I'm really not good at that. I'd like to improve, and I'd love all the resources you can give me to get better at it. Either one of those statements should be perfectly okay for somebody on the team to say, is that, you know, I really don't want to ever touch the financial systems. It's just not my thing. You know, I know it's a database. I know it is, but there's enough particularities about it that I'm not good. And trust within the team is that people can bring their whole selves and won't be dinged for it in some way along the way, that somebody will say, no, I'm not going to keep assigning these to you because I know you hate them, you know, or whatever it is. I think that that's important. And having an environment where those things occur means that a manager can trust that the team isn't going to BS them to cover their own butt or to cover their own, if you want, perceived inadequacies.
That is a fantastic insight. And, you know, I am just really impressed by that insight, to be honest with you, because that is, in fact, what I've seen great managers do. I've done that in my own management positions where I had to manage teams. And I say had to because I don't love it. I'm good at it. I can succeed as a manager, but that's not my favorite thing to do. But I tell you what, you really encapsulated that really well, Leon. The recognition that, you know, some people are great at one thing and not so good at another. And I as your teammate, want to see you succeed. So if I'm good at something and you're not, I'll step up. And I know that you would do the same for me. And so that's a really winning combination.
Right. Exactly. And it lets us move on to another point, I think, which is, you know, how do you keep a team from filtering out the bad news? And I, you know, I've heard managers ask this is, you know, I want to foster an environment of openness so that the team will tell me. I'd rather know the bad news up front first, but I think as a manager, there's certain things you got to do to, you know, sorry to be a, you know, to use a cliche, but to walk the walk, because you're asking a lot from a team to constantly bring you the, you know, I just screwed up, or this isn't going to work, or we're not going to make our deadline. There's some foundation that you have to put down before experienced IT professionals who've been through the ringer a couple of times are just going to, you know, skip lightly into your room and say, I'm just letting you know, boss, that we're going to fail. Like, that's not happening. So what's your take on that?
Yeah. And so true. And I find that the farther up the organization you go, the more prevalent this behavior is. And having worked in some very large enterprises, you know, that had thousands of employees working on administration and dev kinds of things, usually in my experience, it's not at the small team level that you find people not willing to share the bad news. So, you know, let's say it's you and me and a few developers sitting down to discuss status. It wouldn't be, I think, uncommon or uncomfortable for some of our teammates to say, you know, they told us we got to get this done by the end of the month. That's only a few days away, and we are not going to hit that deadline. And you and I look at each other and say, yeah, this is significant. Thanks for sharing. And then we, you know, with the team, we would talk through what can we do to minimize that impact as much as we can. Where it really starts to break down is when that team leader or small group leader then goes and talks to their manager who has a position title of, you know, director or something kind of fancy. People get, I don't know what it is about the transition from the people in the trenches to further up into the executive ranks, but it often breaks down at that point. And sometimes it's because the manager who manages a small team will soften the language because they actually want to protect maybe that one person on the team who's responsible. Because if you can identify one person, you can fire one person, right? Or you can, you know, you can put, so they do it from a position of intending good. But what happens is that manager doesn't really give the full impact of the bad news to the director or the senior manager or what have you. And so the senior manager gets the message that we might miss the deadline at the end of the month instead of no chance we're going to hit this deadline. And then the senior manager takes that up a level and says, you know, we've got a couple parts of the project that are struggling a little bit, but we think we can catch up. And you know what? If we just cut out 2 weeks of testing on this project plan, then we can get it done in time. When in fact, of course, we all know that when you test, you will probably find something that is wrong that needs to be fixed. So, you know, cutting out 2 weeks of testing is based on the ridiculously optimistic, foolishly optimistic idea that there's nothing we got to repair. So that it's kind of like a snowball rolling downhill, except it's going the other direction up to the most senior executives, where one small little change in the emphasis at the lowest level becomes a medium-sized change, becomes a complete untruth by the time you move two or three levels up. And so that's why I always try to give bad news, not in terms of the project or the people in the project, try to give bad news in terms of the business outcomes. And this is something I know you know a lot about as well, Leon. So we could probably have a whole separate conversation about that.
Yeah, we really could. I want to emphasize, though, that part of the reason as an individual contributor that I resist giving bad news, certainly in a skip level or higher when I'm talking to somebody. I actually looked at one of the C-level executives once when they said, well, how's it going? It seems like there's a problem, but I can't tell what it is. And he was looking for me to give him insight. And I said, I cannot tell you because you are a cannon, not a scalpel. Right. And he's like, what do you mean? I says, from the level where you're at, you will want to fix something. But the only way, the level of granularity you have is to blow an entire wall out of the building. That is as precise as you can be. You cannot be surgical about anything, because you walk into a room and the decisions that you make are grand and sweeping and all that. So I can't tell you because it won't fix it. It'll make it worse. But I really want to fix this. I understand. I will deal with it. Not because I'm, a lone wolf, and not because I'm, just going to tough it out or whatever, but because telling you actually will make the problem worse. And I think that a lot of individual contributors have experienced that.
Yeah.
And so they avoid saying anything that they think is going to, again, snowball out of control and end up making the situation worse. But to your point, putting things in business terms, it's not assigning blame. It's, this is the business impact of the current situation. Well, I don't want that. And if you continue to drive back to the business and say, with another $300,000, with another 2 weeks, with another five people, we would be able to avoid this outcome, or whatever it is, you avoid them trying to implement really weird fixes or whip the troops up or, what if I, it's the old joke about the student and the Kung Fu master, and the Kung Fu master says, it will take you a year to master this form. And the student says, what if I work twice as hard? And the master says, it'll take you 2 years. Well, what if I work three times as hard? It'll take you 5 years. Sometimes that's not the right lever to pull. So I love it. So another thing I've heard managers complain about is picking between options or opinions. We know that IT people come in all shapes and sizes, and their personalities can vary wildly and even vary in context. You can have somebody who is very soft-spoken, almost what you would call on the introverted scale in most cases, but you bring up their pet technology or their pet area or the one that they revile the most, and all of a sudden out comes this raging tiger, and you think, wow, Sarah is usually so quiet and whatever, and she must feel really strongly about this, so I'm going to do whatever she says about this. And, loud does not mean correct. Loud doesn't necessarily mean that it's the thing you ought to do. And yet you have managers who have no way of navigating these really interesting IT personalities and passions that come out. So what's a manager to do when, again, they're not technical, they can't pick an argument, they've got two differing opinions. The joke, you have one data center, two technicians, and four opinions. So they've got these massive number of opinions that they have to pick through, no technical basis to pick it on merit. What's a manager supposed to do?
Again, that's a great insight. This is a big issue. And if you've been trained at all, or if you naturally have a kinder heart, then you want your team to come to consensus. We know that managers who function as coaches more than as dictators, right, they're a much more effective manager. And so that means you are soliciting opinions from the professionals on your team. They are professionals, after all. And IT people love being respected and acknowledged for their intelligence and their thought processes and things like that. So when you ask for opinions, you actually are building kind of a positive feedback loop that makes the people that you're asking an opinion feel good. And the fact that you're asking for consensus also makes the team feel good and valued. So that's great. One of the things, though, that happens in that situation is, like you said, usually the loudest and most outspoken person wins. And that's because a lot of people who are more introverted, and there are more introverts in IT than other personality types, they're more likely to, you know, say, it's not that big of a deal. And what they propose works okay. Mine is a better idea, but I don't, you know, it's not worth fighting for. Well, there's some things you can do to really help make this more balanced. And there's some books recently that have come out that have kind of gone into this. There are also some of the different kinds of psychometric tests, like Myers-Briggs. And I'm not saying predicate your entire approach to life based on those kinds of things, but, you know, seek advice where it seems to be applicable. And so one of the things that you can do to really improve that consensus building process is that typically introverted people don't like to make spot decisions. So if we had a regular standing meeting on Thursdays and, you know, and Leon walked in and said, okay, people, you know, we've been bouncing around the idea of maybe we can find a second network provider so that we meet this corporate goal of having redundant network trunks into the data center. We thought about it. We talked about it. Let's decide today which one we're going to do. You basically have ensured that most of your introverts are not really going to contribute to that conversation. So, for example, when I was the president of the Professional Association for SQL Server, I did that a couple times with the board of directors. I said, let's decide today. You know, we only meet in person once a quarter. Let's figure this out. Well, what happened was two or three people ran the conversation and it was done. And I was not happy with that outcome. So we regrouped, and what we decided to do going forward was that anything that has to be decided on is never going to be a spot decision. Tomorrow, we're going to make the decision. And today, I'm telling you, we're going to make that decision tomorrow. Here's all the information we've collected about it. Now digest that, think about it, maybe write out what you would like to see happen in this situation. And everybody has to say something. If you say nothing, that assumes not agreement, that assumes that you disagree. And so if you have nothing really to say, then that's what you're going to say. So when it comes around to Sheila, and Sheila is now asked to, you know, which of these different plans do you support? She needs to either say, I support one or the other, or my own proposal, or I don't really have an opinion on this. But it's not okay to just sit back and not say anything. And when people who are introverted and not prone to speaking up know that they have to at least say a few words sometime in the near future, tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, they're going to participate in that conversation. So there was an old commercial from back in my younger days, and I think yours too, Leon. The commercial was when such and such talks.
E.F. Hutton.
E.F. Hutton. That's the one.
Yep. E.F. Hutton. When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. So a couple things I want to say. First of all, whether you are a Myers-Briggs person or a StrengthsFinders person or some other, as you said, psychometric test, the first thing is to understand that as a manager, you need to have a way of understanding people and personalities that are different from your experiences, that they exist and they process information and they interact with the world differently. And the second thing on the other side is to recognize that any of those tests or assets are frameworks. They're not solutions. They don't give you the answer. They simply give you a context in which to process the experiences you're having differently, to recognize that, to your point, Sheila isn't quiet or shy. She takes a different approach to processing information and then expressing an opinion on it, and that it is valid, but it's not the same as, you know, Tony, who's like right out there, out and loud and in your face about things, which also isn't wrong. I want to recommend for those people who happen to be on the more outgoing side of the world, that would be me, is the book Quiet by Susan Cain is a great way to understand not just why or how people are, again, we'll say introverted, but also the benefits, the strengths that folks who tend to think a little slower and a little bit more, you know, carefully about things bring to the organization. So that's important also. Kevin, we can go on about this, I think, literally all day. I think we have another 6 hours of material here to talk about. And I believe that we will get to that in a future episode at some point. But for right now, I think this is enough to be getting along with. So first of all, I just want to thank you for joining me for a really incredible conversation.
Great fun. Really enjoyed it, Leon. Thank you.
And thank you to everyone else who was listening.
Folks, you know, we know that you have a choice in podcasts. There's so much content out there to consume. So we want to make a special note that we appreciate that you're spending the time with us, listening, and hopefully contributing in the future. I know that I always love to hear comments from those of you who are listening. And on behalf of Leon, I would say we would both love to have a conversation with you on Twitter, LinkedIn, other kinds of social media, or even via email if you like. So thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen to ours.
Absolutely. And you can find Kevin on the socials. You can find him on Twitter at K.E. Kline. That's K-L-I-N-E. And also on LinkedIn. And of course, on the SolarWinds community, thwack.com. And you can find all that in the show notes. I would like to remind everyone, if you like this episode, we'd love it if you would follow, rate, review the podcast, smash the like button, whatever you're going to do. For SolarWinds Tech Pod, I'm Leon Adato.
And I'm Kevin Kline. Until next time, thank you everyone for listening.